The grand jury presentment in the Jerry Sandusky case is painful reading. In 1998, a mother complained that her 11-year-old son was bear-hugged by Sandusky when both were naked in the shower at Penn State. The police secretly recorded her confronting Sandusky twice. That case was closed without charges being brought, but a university police detective who knew about it did tell Sandusky to stop showering with children. 4 years later, a graduate coaching assistant said he witnessed another 11-year-old boy being raped in the shower by Sandusky, but neither he nor his supervisors went to the police. Reporter Sarah Ganim of the Patriot News in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, sums up all the evidence in this case in a special report today, and she joins us from State College, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And let's start with that 1998 incident. It's not the first chronologically, but the mother complained, the police investigated. What happened?
Basically, the child came home from a tour of the Penn State football building with Jerry Sandusky. He came home and he told his mom, "If you're wondering why my hair is wet, it's because we took a shower together." And then he ran into his bedroom and slammed the door, and she says she immediately called police. He was interviewed along with another boy around the same age who was also in the shower at the time, and the boys told police that Sandusky bear-hugged them while they took naked showers together. There was a six-week investigation by the police, by the district attorney's office, and part of that included this setup in the mother's house. Jerry Sandusky had asked that he come over and explain to her what happened in his words. So the police decided to hide in another room and listen. And he told the mother that he did take a shower with her son. He told her he wished he had her forgiveness, but he knew he wasn't going to get it. And then he said, "I wish I were dead."
Well, a university police detective knew this, according to the grand jury. Do we know who up and down the Penn State administrative ladder knew about that case, which again resulted in no criminal charge?
All we really know about who knew, and this is just from the grand jury presentment, is that Vice President for Finance and Business, who has now resigned, Gary Schultz, said that when another incident was reported 4 years later, he acknowledged that there were similarities to the one in 1998. So we know that he had to have read it at some point. But the person who made the decision not to prosecute the case was Ray Grecar, and he's a prosecutor who has been missing for 7 years and was declared legally dead over the summer because they have no leads in his case. So we can't exactly go ask him why he decided not to
pursue this. not to prosecute. But when you say similarities, it's an understatement. We're talking about 11-year-old boys in the shower. Alarm bells would have gone off in 2002 if anyone knew anything about the 1998 investigation.
Well, I mean, that's something that you could assume. If you look at the grand jury presentment, it's really split into two categories. And one category is two victims who say that they endured prolonged abuse, almost like a relationship type of status with Jerry Sandusky. And then the other ones are single incidents of contact in a shower. So you would think in any of those circumstances that alarm bells would go off. And, you know, at the press conference to announce the charges on Monday, the state police commissioner said he has actually never seen anything like it in his career, where someone witnesses a sex act against a child and it didn't lead to charges.
You list in your special report today the different years when people might have acted and didn't act. And it was really quite often that this could have been stopped.
I do think that that's true. I think there were a lot of missed opportunities throughout at least a 15-year period. Now, I also think we need to keep in mind that police are getting tips. I mean, this has become a huge story, and there's a lot of national media in State College right now, and they're all doing stories all day long, and it's gotten a lot of attention. And the state police have said that they've gotten at least two calls. You know, I think there's a potential for us to find that there were missed opportunities even beyond that 15 years.
Well, Sarah Ganim of the Patriot News of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
For Democrats, there was a flash of optimism in off-year election results this week. Voters in Ohio soundly rejected Republican Governor John Kasich's plan to scale back collective bargaining rights for public employees. The vote was a big victory for labor. In particular, it illustrated the importance of the nation's teachers' unions well beyond the classroom. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, teachers' groups are mobilizing like never before. because they face threats to their very existence.
Teachers' unions joined a coalition of workers to produce the ads that helped defeat Issue 2 in Ohio.
How dare those politicians and lobbyists and special interest insiders attack the people who teach our children for a living?
Labor spent millions on the referendum, which overturned restrictions on collective bargaining. According to Kim Anderson of the National Education Association, her teachers' group contributed the lion's share.
We did, more than $10 million.
The NEA says it's the biggest labor union in 48 states, with more than 3 million members nationwide. Those numbers help build a big war chest, and Anderson says it also means the NEA could contribute lots of foot soldiers to the Ohio fight.
Folks from at least 20 state affiliates that went into Ohio on their own volition because they wanted to help.
They're coming because these collective bargaining fights threaten some unions' very existence. The issue has become more urgent since Wisconsin public workers lost a fight over collective bargaining rights earlier this year. As a result, some locals lost the ability to collect dues automatically from paychecks, and now hundreds of teachers' locals in Wisconsin must hold elections to say whether they still want the union to represent them. That's why the Tuesday results in Ohio were important. So was a small but important victory in Michigan. There, the Michigan Education Association mounted a successful recall campaign against a state representative who symbolized the Republican effort to cut spending and limit union power. Doug Pratt is spokesman for the MEA.
They spent more time vilifying unions and attacking the middle class of this state than they have putting people back to work. That's not what they were sent to Lansing to do, and the voters are going to hold them accountable for that.
Former Representative Paul Scott, the victim of the recall, says he expected a response from labor, but he was surprised when the union focused its organizing efforts on a recall.
You're talking about the most entrenched and well-financed government employee union in any state. It's going to be the teachers' union. They just immediately went toward my community and started protests.
The union targeted other lawmakers for recall, but those efforts failed. Displays of union power just give new ammunition to the growing number of anti-union groups and websites like teachersunionexposed.com. Justin Wilson says his website tries to uncover how labor protects ineffective teachers from being fired.
To actually get a hold of proceedings where teachers have been disciplined, to sort of get to the very bottom of how many teachers in this country are terminated, working through their onerous collective bargaining agreements that make it nearly impossible.
This summer, the National Education Association increased dues by $10. Some of that money will be directed at preserving bargaining rights. Wisconsin teachers are also pushing for their own recall effort against Governor Walker. These are all expensive battles, but for teachers' unions, they're a matter of life and death. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
We've been listening to anxious news from Europe for a while now, a grim message hovering on the edges of our minds about possibly being dragged into more financial disorder by one or more members of Europe's dysfunctional family. And we're watching the Republican candidates struggle to gain ground in a race where potential voters appear to change their minds every few minutes and without much enthusiasm. But I have to say, things look remarkably good in the face of this uneasy season, because the season is fall, autumn. We're reading new books for a new school year. We're right between two holidays, which are our national favorites, Halloween and Thanksgiving. And the weather is changing in a wonderful way, at least here in Washington. Yesterday, I walked out of the house and almost tripped in my effort not to step on a perfect maple leaf that blew up on the porch in the night. It was as large as my hand and yellow as butter. It made me smile and sent me on my way, a simple gift. Growing up in New Mexico, this was also the season when our house began to smell strongly of bourbon. My dad had a neighborhood grocery store, and my mom made fruitcake as gifts for customers. Now, this was great fruitcake. Lemon-flavored, golden-colored, only the good kinds of fruit, none of that bitter, break-your-tooth kind. Of course, we didn't pay retail for all that candied fruit. The cakes had to be baked, wrapped in tea towels and sprinkled with bourbon, and stored for a month or so. Another relatively simple gift, homemade. Now, in this economy, keeping things simple is a necessity for many people. Even people who still have their jobs have concerns about living like they used to do. We are saving more and are thinking before we buy something big. Although many people have found themselves in financial trouble for something they could not control, a business closing, moving, downsizing, people appear to be reconsidering what they can control. Taking responsibility, as all these candidates like to say. But it may be more than that. It may be that we've turned some kind of corner, that we've changed the way we think, at least a little bit. Instead of waiting for things to be as good for us as they used to be, maybe we're redefining good. You're listening to NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. When we burn fossil fuels, we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide contributes to global warming. But the world's smokestacks also emit pollutants that offset some of that warming. A new study shows that cleaning up air pollution could actually heat the planet more than scientists had previously thought. NPR's Richard Harris has this report.
Power plants not only produce carbon dioxide, they spew soot as well as compounds of nitrogen and sulfur and other stuff into the air. It's a complicated soup of material known as aerosols. And Natalie Mahowald at Cornell University says, so far, scientists have mostly tried to understand what those aerosols do while they're actually in the air.
There are so many different kinds of aerosols, and they have many different sources, and some warm and some cool. But in the net, humans are emitting a lot of extra aerosols, and it seems to be that they tend to cool for the most part.
The aerosols reflect sunlight back into space, or they stimulate clouds that keep us cool. But it turns out that's not all they do. Mahowald says these aerosols also influence how much carbon dioxide gets drawn out of the air by plants on land and in the sea.
They can add nutrients, for example, to the oceans or to the land. But also while they were in the atmosphere, they changed the climate, and so that also can impact how much carbon the land or the ocean can take up. So there's quite a few different ways that aerosols can interact.
In an article published in Science magazine, she concludes that those effects add up to quite a bit, which means at the moment aerosols are not only helping reduce global warming by cooling the atmosphere, but they're helping reduce the amount of carbon dioxide that stays in the air once we emit it. That's good news. For now, it means the planet isn't heating up quite as fast as it could be. But it's bad news looking down the road a little bit. That's because many aerosols make people sick, heart and lung disease in particular. So some nations are now in the process of trying to rein them in.
As we clean up the aerosols, which we really want to do for public health reasons, we're going to be perhaps causing ourselves more trouble in terms of the climate situation.
This is not a brand new idea. For example, other research has found that if we switch from coal to much cleaner natural gas, that might not do much to help with global warming because we'd also be reducing the pollutants in coal smoke that help offset warming. Mahowald's results suggest that reducing those pollutants could be an even bigger problem than we'd realized when you consider that aerosols help remove carbon dioxide from the air by encouraging plant growth. Hard numbers on this effect are highly uncertain at the moment, but this could turn out to be quite significant.
This is something that is really poorly studied. I think that's the main point of the paper, is we've really been ignoring this potentially important topic.
And studying it is not easy because the effects aren't well understood. For example, nitrogen can be a fertilizer, but it can stunt plant growth when nitrogen comes out of the air in acid form. Lisa Emberson at the Stockholm Environment Institute studies those biological cycles, and she says there are so many subtle effects, it's hard to be sure which ones will prove to be the most important.
The take-home message of this paper is that we need to understand those interactions far better, and we probably need to take action much more quickly than we are doing at the moment.
Right now, it seems we're much more likely to clean up aerosol pollution while increasing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air. So, scientists, unfortunately, may have a chance to see how this inadvertent experiment on our planet starts to play out. Richard Harris, NPR News.
This is Weekends on All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. The women of the French Resistance came from all over France. The Nazis entered Paris in the early hours of June 14, 1940, and what surprised everyone was how quickly France fell. Most of the populace watched and waited as swastikas went up on the Parisian boulevards, but not everyone. Journalist and biographer Caroline Moorhead's latest book, A Train in Winter, An Extraordinary Story of Women, Friendship, and Resistance in Occupied France, chronicles what happened to 230 French women from all over the country who did not accept the occupation quietly. The women ranged in age from a 15-year-old schoolgirl, she'd written Vive les Anglais on the wall of her lycée, to a 67-year-old widow who ran a boarding house. Many of them were communists, the party most organized to resist the occupier. But not all of them were even particularly political. They were strangers to each other, for the most part, united in opposition to occupation, the treatment of the Jews, the trampling of France. Moore had researched what happened to these women during and after they were sent as a group to Auschwitz on January 24, 1943. And she joins me now from our London bureau to talk about her book, Caroline Moorhead. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
A few years ago, you went in search of survivors of a convoy called 31,000. And this was the convoy that took these women to Auschwitz. You found four of them, Betty, Cecile, Madeleine, Poupette. Tell me a little bit about them.
It was very exciting finding those four. There were two others alive, but they were not well enough to see me. Those four women were extraordinary and very different one from the other. Cecile came from Brittany. She was a furrier's apprentice. She was a stocky, tough-minded woman of huge charm, and she had joined the resistance. She'd been a communist and she'd become a courier for the resistance. And her story was particularly interesting or particularly touching to me because she had a young daughter. So she went to her mother and said to her mother, would she look after her young daughter while she went underground? And the mother said, I don't know how you can do this since you have a child. And Cecile replied, it is because I have a child that I'm doing it. I do not want a daughter of mine to grow up in a world governed by the German occupiers and Vichy. That was Cecile. Mm-hmm. Betty came from Paris, where she was a secretary. And she was extremely elegant and very, very dressed up. And she travelled about all over France carrying messages for the networks in her shopping bags. And when she was on the trains going across the demarcation line, she used to very often get the German officers who were travelling on the same train to carry her suitcase, which might well contain pamphlets for the underground or even radio transmitters. There was Poupette, who was only 17 in 1942, and she and her elder sister Marie, whose parents had a hotel in Rennes, had hidden radio transmitters. And Poupette spent 7 months in solitary confinement, not knowing that her sister was in fact in a cell just up the corridor from her. And the last one, Madeleine, was a schoolteacher in Normandy, and she had helped organise a sabotage of a train. So you see, these women were very different kinds of women.
They all end up in a prison called Romainville, just outside Paris, where this incredible bond begins to form between them.
They started coming together by the late spring of 1942. And quite soon, these women began to form friendships. They were in dormitories. They shared their food. They taught each other things. Poupette told me that for her it had been the most extraordinary education because she had missed a lot of schooling because of the war. When she found herself in Romainville, she started listening to these women. And because these women were teachers and philosophers and journalists and doctors, she learnt a huge amount.
In January of 1943, they're put on a train heading east. This is the train for which you named the book, the Convoy 31,000. What follows is harrowing. And I have to say that your reportage, you have a long background in human rights reportage, is so detailed that it is very difficult to read, and yet we must read it. 230 of these women are on this convoy. Only 49 of them will come back. What happens?
When they got there, it was quickly plain that some, particularly the very much older ones, would not survive at all. Though what they actually died of is very hard to say because, after all, they didn't have typhus and they weren't gassed and it was too soon to die of hunger. They died of sort of horror, really, the older ones. Some of the younger ones died very quickly, died calling for their mothers. They just also didn't have the psychological strength, if you like. Typhus took a lot of them, took Danielle Casanova, who'd been rather one of their leaders, who was a dentist and a very sort of tough, robust young woman. And many of those friends were, of course, split up, and Marie, Poupette's sister, died. And this was heartbreaking for all the others. But they really then set about looking after each other. And one of the most touching things one of them said to me was, you have to understand that there came a moment when our own deaths were no more important to us than the deaths of our friends. What we were determined to do was to get as many people through this as we could.
Caroline Moorhead, one of the most tragic parts of this story is after they return from these horrors of captivity, their lives are really, for the most part, quite scarred and broken by what they experienced. A third of them die within the next decade. Why was that?
When I started out on this book, the general feeling was that I was going to write yet another gloomy book. And I said, no, it'll be perfectly all right when you get to the end. You'll only just have a small gloomy bit when they're in Auschwitz. And after that, they'll come home and everything will be good and they'll be happy. The problem was that what they had been through was too much. Now, a number did come back and make new lives. They married very often other people who'd been in the resistance. They had children or they came back to their own children. And they more or less put their lives together. A number didn't. A number just simply could not put it behind them.
Eventually, though, the French do recognize them. Many of them are given the Légion d'honneur, the Medal of Honor. You met four of them in person, as we said at the beginning, women, for the most part, in their mid-90s, amazing survivors, living independently. What was it like to be in their presence?
They were extremely friendly and warm, and they were extremely keen to tell their stories. One of the problems for these women is when they got back, it was not until the summer of 1945, when France had been liberated for a year, and nobody really wanted to hear their stories. They were these sad, emaciated, anxious, depressed women, and they weren't part of what the new France wanted. And I had the feeling when I went to see them that they were longing to tell their whole story from beginning to end to somebody who really, really wanted to listen. I mean, it was a remarkable thing for me to be able to do this.
That's Caroline Moorhead. Her new book is called A Train in Winter, an extraordinary story of women, friendship, and resistance in occupied France. And extraordinary it is. Caroline Moorhead, thank you so very much.
Thank you very much.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. This weekend, the eyes of the art world are turned toward Bentonville, Arkansas. That's where the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art is opening its doors for the first time. Walmart heiress Alice Walton spent the last decade acquiring great works spanning the entire history of art in America. The result is a top-tier collection in a region that's never had one before. But Walton's critics say her unprecedented spending spree has made other museums and cities poorer. NPR's Joel Rose reports.
At a press preview of Crystal Bridges, curator David Houston led reporters on a tour of the modern wing.
In this gallery, you will have a wall of small Jackson Pollocks from his psychoanalytical period. There's a wall here that's the 40s with David Smith drawing.
It's been 50 years since anyone opened a major museum dedicated to American art. Crystal Bridges is even more impressive when you consider that it spans four centuries from the colonial era to the present day. John Wilmerding is a professor of art history at Princeton and a longtime advisor to Alice Walton.
Nobody, including myself as an American, has thought that you could begin to acquire great American masterpieces in today's market. We had all thought they were already in public collections or in private hands.
Alice Walton has shown that there are still masterpieces to be had if you've got piles of money and the stomach for some controversy.
She's controversial for a reason.
Journalist Lee Rosenbaum writes the blog Culture Girl. Rosenbaum was one of many New Yorkers who were shocked in 2005 when the New York Public Library decided to sell the iconic Hudson River School painting Kindred Spirits by Asher Durand for a reported $35 million.
The library decided to sell it. Alice Walton acquired it, causing a great uproar in New York, which considered it a quintessentially New York painting. It's the Catskill Mountains going to the Ozarks.
Even Walton's defenders concede that she's had a measurable effect on the art market. Eric Whiting is vice president of American art at Christie's, which has helped Walton build her collection.
Alice's presence in the marketplace has clearly brought out works of art that might not otherwise have been offered for sale.
One example might be the Gross Clinic, perhaps the greatest work by 19th century Philadelphia painter Thomas Aikens. Christie's helped to sell the painting for $68 million. Whiting says he worked with the seller, Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, to make sure that local museums would have a chance to match the price.
Before we even called Alice, and she was our first phone call, we advised her that it was going to be opened up to broader bidding to the museums in Philadelphia. They were able to match her bid, and the painting remained in Philadelphia. That's great. And it was an open, transparent process which benefited everybody.
Including Jefferson, which used the proceeds to improve its campus. Still, the transaction left a bad taste in the mouth of critics like Stephen Kahn, who teaches public history at Ohio State University.
There was an almost extortionate quality to what Jefferson University did. It announced it was going to sell this painting, and then it gave people a ticking clock of 6 weeks to try and match the offer from Alice Walton.
But Walton's advisor, John Wilmerding, insists that she isn't forcing anyone to sell anything.
She didn't go to the Jefferson Medical College, say, I want to buy the Gross Clinic. It was offered to her through Christie's. They decided to sell it. So to turn it around and say she's raiding is a little bit off.
Walton's critics agree that the institutions on the selling end have a responsibility here, too. Ethical guidelines in the museum field say you should only sell a work of art in order to buy more art. But those rules don't necessarily apply to libraries and schools that happen to own valuable artworks. Consider Fisk University in Nashville. The struggling school struck a $30 million deal with Crystal Bridges to share its collection of paintings by Georgia O'Keeffe and others. That deal is still tied up in court. Nevertheless, blogger Lee Rosenbaum says it shows Alice Walton's destabilizing effect on the art world.
You can't exactly blame Alice for taking advantage of opportunities. On the other hand, her resources are so great that they provide a tremendous temptation for museums and other cultural institutions to monetize works that would better remain in their own communities.
Alice Walton also paid a visit to what was then Randolph-Macon Women's College in Virginia shortly before the school's board decided to put its valuable painting collection up for auction. But Walton's advisor, John Wilmerding, counters that it would be better for these works to wind up in a museum like Crystal Bridges than in a private collector's living room.
Whatever the controversy of the payment or the acquisition, they're in the public domain. She's bought them for the public good, and that's, to me, the answer that ends it.
One thing everyone seems to agree on is that Crystal Bridges will serve a part of the country, Northwest Arkansas, that's never had a great art museum before. And historian Stephen Kahn says Alice Walton, with her Walmart fortune, is not so different from the 19th century robber barons who built the great museums of the East Coast.
This is exactly what places like Boston and New York were deliberately trying to do themselves. We're more than just a collection of businessmen. We have high culture, too, and we're going to build the Metropolitan Museum of Art to prove it. And that's essentially what she's doing in Bentonville, Arkansas, 100 years later.
If history is any guide, the success of Crystal Bridges may ultimately be judged by what's on the walls and not on how it got there. Joel Rose, NPR News, Philadelphia.